Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner from John Coltrane to Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute of Policy Studies, as we get an analysis of what this deal means with Iran. Phyllis, welcome. Thank you so much for being patient.
No problem. It's amazing to be compared to John Coltrane. That's a high bar.
We can call it the John Coltrane of Middle Eastern analysis.
That's a high bar.
So Phyllis, talk about this deal that was just made, this agreement.
Yeah, the deal is, aside from all the details, the deal is a great victory for diplomacy over war. It proves that diplomacy works, and it has averted the very real possibility, Mark, that there could be a war with Iran. So for all those reasons, this is a huge victory. It's a victory of all the people who fought so hard to prevent and then to stop war against Iraq, because it made the price of war politically higher. You know, if we look back, if we look, for example, at the massive global protest of February 15th, 2003, when there were somewhere around 14 million people who took to the streets on one day in 665 cities all around the world, and people were all speaking in one voice in a million different languages saying, the world says no to war. It was at the time the biggest global protest that had ever happened in history. Now, a lot of people later said, you know, at the end of the day, we failed because we didn't stop the war in Iraq. Now, that's true. We didn't stop the war in Iraq. But I think it would be a mistake to say we failed, because I think 4 years later, in 2007, George Bush was very, very close to going to war against Iran. And the reason he didn't was because there was a political assessment in the administration, in the White House, that the political cost was going to be just too high, both internationally and at home. And I think we're seeing the same thing now. I think that President Obama wanted to do this. I think he sees it as his legacy, et cetera. But the pressures have been extreme. And I think that if there had not been massive public opposition that had strengthened the usually wiggling, waffling, weak opposition that we see in inside the Washington bubble, I think that there would have been a real danger that we could have been at war with Iran. And for that, I think that everybody who was out in the streets on February 15th and who worked so hard ever since can claim this victory as their own.
I mean, that's an interesting analysis. I mean, to look at this in terms of the both the power from the power from the outside that people, as you said, often feel is not effective, because you can't immediately feel or see or witness what you may have done with standing up against war.
Right. It's a very difficult thing. I was reading an article last night from a guy who was one of the key originators of the Occupy Wall Street mobilization, and he was assessing sort of what happened as a result of that movement. But his overview was, this was a failure. Our movement failed. And then he went on to say why it was an important failure, a failure we can learn from, et cetera. But I read it thinking, I don't think it failed. I mean, it failed if your standard is anything's a failure short of full revolutionary transformation of this country in one fell swoop. Now, yeah, Occupy didn't do that. So if that's your standard, yeah, it failed. But Occupy almost single-handedly or single-movemently or whatever, however you would say that, was clearly responsible for a massive transformation of the public and the elite and political discourse in this country away from the whole debate about deficit and the debt to a dialogue about inequality that has stuck to this day. 4 years later, we're still talking about inequality as the most important factor, and I think that goes right back to the Occupy movement. So if you want to say that's a failure, boy, you have a way different standard than I do.
and analyzing what just happened, this negotiated deal between these various powers around the world and Iran, what does it mean for the shape of, do you think, of our relations with Iran from here on in, and the power of Iran and its power relationship to the rest of the Middle East, which is what many people who oppose this deal are talking about?
Right, and I think they're right to be talking about it. There is a potential, I don't think it's inevitable, but there is a potential that this could be really the first step, not a final step, but the first step towards a very serious kind of reworking of not only the U.S.-Iranian relationship, which is key, you know, the what's been called for a long time the grand bargain, the idea that there would be a new set of negotiations between the U.S. and Iran where essentially everything is on the table. You know, that was not the case here. These were very narrow negotiations. So all the people that say, including Bibi Netanyahu again this morning, in his usual threatening tone, saying, well, this was a failure because it didn't deal with Iran's role in the region, and it didn't deal with conventional weapons, and it didn't deal with human rights. And it's like, yeah, that's why it succeeded, because it was designed to deal with nuclear weapons and the sanctions that were the result of nuclear weapons, period, full stop. If you wanted to put in all those other things, you would have had an entirely different kind of negotiations, one in which the U.S. was almost certainly not willing to participate in. Now, whether the Iranians would have is a different matter, but they have indicated in the past an eagerness to engage in that kind of serious negotiation on the whole set of questions involving the role of Iran as a regional power, the question of how the U.S. sees Iran since the overthrow of the U.S.-backed Shah, et cetera. And I think that there is the possibility, as a result of this agreement, that something like that could happen down the road. It's not going to happen anytime soon. What does change is the sense, and I think this is why you're seeing such hysteria from not only the Israeli government, but from key right. leaders in the right-wing Arab states that are allied with Israel, like Saudi Arabia, Jordan, some of the other, the UAE, etc. These absolute monarchs are very worried about the rise of Iran as a regional hegemon, because what is going on right now across the Middle East, and we see this particularly in Syria in the context of what we sort of call the Syrian civil war, but which is actually at least seven different wars that are all being fought to the last Syrian. And in that context, the competition for regional power between Iran and Saudi Arabia in particular is a key component. The sectarian struggle between Shia and Sunni Islam, personified by Iran versus Saudi Arabia, is another one of those seven wars going on in Syria. So in that context, there's a great deal of fear that ending the decades of absolute antagonism, absolute hostility from the United States towards Iran could end up strengthening Iran as a potential regional hegemon, a potential and continuing challenger to Saudi domination of the region in concert with Israel. So that's what I think they're dealing with right now. And I think the immediate decision of the U.S. is, we're not going to talk about any of that at this point. We're going to run off to the region. I think Secretary Kerry is likely to be in the region in the next couple of days, meeting with Arab leaders to reassure them, essentially, and then he'll go to Israel as well, to reassure them that nothing will change. We will continue to spend $3.1 billion just as a starting amount every year in U.S. taxpayer money to go directly to the Israeli military. We will continue to sell Saudi Arabia as many weapons as they want for as many tens of billions of dollars as our weapons industry wants to sell them. So nothing is going to change. But in the longer term, I think this does posit the possibility of real change in the region. You know, there have been situations in the past, and in fact it's going on now if you look at the situation in Iraq, where the U.S. and Iran, as antagonistic as they may be towards each other, and regardless of the levels of rhetoric about crazy mullahs on the one hand and the great Satan on the other hand, they are working on the same side, supporting the same proxies, and against the same target, which is ISIS. So this notion that, you know, the U.S. has nothing to say to Iran, that there's no basis for a relationship with Iran, this is all nonsense. You know, you can go back a little further. Right after 9/11, Iran was designated by the special envoy of the Bush administration to the talks in Germany that led to the creation of the new the U.S.-backed Afghan government after the overthrow of the Taliban, James Dobbins. He wrote in his reports that the Iranian delegation was by far the closest ally the U.S. had in that multilateral meeting designed mm-hmm. to take over Afghanistan, essentially, and create a Western-oriented government, and Iran was completely willing to collaborate on that. Of course, the answer they got from the Bush administration was to be lumped into the so-called axis of evil, and that, not surprisingly, kind of antagonized a few people in Tehran. But besides that, it was evidence of this kind of strategic alliance that exists, whatever the rhetoric, whatever the politics, at the level of fighting on the ground, for all the reasons that I think it's not going to work, both the U.S. and Iran are engaged together in this military strategy to fight against ISIS, to challenge the rise of some of these jihadist organizations, etc. So there's, you know, both from the vantage point of kind of realist militarists who are just interested in shoring up U.S. power in the Middle East, and from the vantage point of those who are trying to move towards a much more divided level of power, rather than having power all concentrated in one or two hegemonic powers in the region, to expand that power to a multiplicity of power centers in the Middle East, the possibility of a normalized Iran becomes very important.
Yeah, and just finally, I think that this is a great analysis you've just given us. And I think that also you're seeing the complexities of politics both inside of Iran and inside the United States, where the more stringent elements in Iran and the military and the more right-wing elements in America, conservative elements, are both really opposed to this deal.
Absolutely. And they're opposed for it. They're opposed to it partly because of the ideological part. You can't deal with Iran. They're our implacable enemy. And you don't need evidence if you just sort of put it in the context of, they've always been our enemy. They've been our enemy because they still burn American flags.
Like, right.
Really? You know, that's your definition of an enemy. But whatever. You know, so part of it is that. And part of it is for people in the Congress, in the White House, in the Pentagon, in the industries who depend on huge customers in the region to buy weapons, you know, who depend on Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf states, the oil industry that has historically been willing to buy oil from Iran but has closer ties, say, to Saudi Arabia, you know, they're a little ambivalent about it. But the interests go way beyond that sort of ideological part. And then you have the question of Israel. Israel has, I shouldn't say Israel, in this context, it's Bibi Netanyahu and his circles have staked out as their kind of ultimate legitimizing position in the world, the claim, the completely false claim, that Iran represents an existential threat to the state of Israel. Of course, it doesn't. It's never attacked Israel. It's never invaded. It's never done any of those things. It doesn't have a nuclear weapon, unlike Israel, which does have between 100 and 400 high-density nuclear bombs in their plant in Dimona. What Iran would represent, if it ever made the decision that the U.S. intelligence agencies agrees it has never made, if it made a decision to try and get a nuclear weapon, that would even not represent an existential threat. It would represent a threat to Israel's current nuclear
monopoly.
Right. That's what it would threaten. It's not an existential danger. But anyone in the Congress who still believes what is no longer true, whether it ever was or not, that it's political suicide to criticize Israel or disagree with Israel. Anyone who still believes that, they're going to accept that sort of parameter of what is acceptable discourse and what isn't. And in that context, anything good about Iran, anything that's anything other than we must be militantly vigilant against Iran, they're not going to accept. So you have this kind of ideologically driven opposition, and you saw it in the absurdity of these members of Congress, the Senate, the House, coming out and condemning the resolution, the agreement, before it was even signed, and then within moments of its being signed, as we thought, this is a terrible agreement, this is a terrible decision, this is a terrible thing that President Obama has done. When the thing is 150 pages long, they hadn't even seen it yet, let alone read it,
Of course, they have not read it nor seen it. And Phyllis Bennis, I'm sorry to not spend more time on this. We will do it again in the next week, I hope.
I look forward to it.
Phyllis Bennis, Director of New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Thank you once again so much for joining us here on the Mark Steiner Show with your analysis.
Thank you, Mark. It's been a pleasure.
Take care. We're taking a very brief break. Love Will Tear Us Apart by Joy Division. Ian Curtis of Joy Division, born on this day in 1956. We're coming back with a very special program, coming to Baltimore tonight to create some healing between policing and community. Stay with us.